This is the October 3rd, 2016 environmental law class, and we are making our first foray into Clean Air Act law. So let me give you the big picture, which is this is a very complicated portion of environmental law, but the big picture concepts are actually fairly straightforward. What I'd like to do is to give you a center of gravity today on the big picture of the act. Bless you. The concepts, the way that it applies, and then that way when we dive into the breaking down of the statutes, concepts, and their follow-up classes, you'll have a framework that will help you bring good some context for all of it. So with that in mind, let me go ahead and start with the big picture, which is the Clean Air Act itself, and then we're going to talk about air quality today. The Clean Air Act, my first pointer to you is that there is no Clean Air Act. There is actually a collection of small mini statutes that all live under the same name, but they're actually very different in nature. So as a result, when you're talking about the Clean Air Act, you oftentimes are finding yourself wandering in a small reservation within the Clean Air Act. They're all broken down by title. Six titles are all we're going to care about in this class. Now, what I'd like to do is give you a sense of which ones apply and how, and then we're going to focus most of our effort on starting with Title I. Title I is what we call ambient air quality. Quite simply, if we walked out our door right now, and I seriously thought about bringing an air monitor so we could do this in class today, and took a sample of the air, what's there, can we breathe it safely, and how we determine whether or not what a safe level is. Completely separate is mobile sources, Title II. It's what it sounds like, cars, but not just cars. It covers cars, trucks, mobile sources like locomotives, heavy construction equipment, airplanes. If it moves, Title II, what applies to it. That's important because, as we're going to find out today, Title II and Title I take fundamentally different approaches on how to regulate air pollution from the sources that they regulate. Title III is a particularly fun one. Air toxics, stuff that kills you dead. This is the stuff that you would really have to pay close attention to because it's the sort of emissions that we deal with predominantly in the ship channel, or with the refinery row, or if you're going to Southeast Louisiana, or the west coast of California. The thing about air toxics is that because they are so hazardous in such small amounts, they're regulated very intensively. And as a result, this is where the toughest standards are of the Clean Air Act. You have enormous fights over the scope of coverage and what technology is going to determine what standard you have to meet. We'll save this for a future class. The next one is going to sound a little weird, and you're going to ask yourselves, I predict, why would I care about that? But these are provisions in Title IV for acid rain. Now, I'm going to date myself. How many of you have actually heard about acid rain or worried about it? Okay, great, it's still, because this was a big issue in the 70s and 80s. And it was essentially acid rain due to smokestack emissions from coal-fired power plants on the East Coast, were essentially causing a pH change in water bodies all downwind, and causing forest die-offs, fish mortality, dead lakes. So Title IV is a special purpose portion of the Act that deals just with acid rain. Now, frankly, we just don't worry as much about acid rain down here in Texas, except maybe potentially, well, let's put it this way, as a phenomenon, not legally. But as we'll talk about, acid rain is important because it ultimately ended up being the laboratory for some of the most innovative ideas in the Clean Air Act. Congress authorized particularly for here the first mass regulatory system based on markets, where you buy your right to pollute and sell it to other people, and it drives technological innovation to reduce your emissions without EPA pointing a long bony finger and saying, thou must do so. Title V is a reaction to the fact that we had the four titles before. Picture you are an environmental advocate. You are representing your neighborhood. You want to find out whether or not the giant monolithic facility next door is complying with all these requirements. In the old days, you had to go back and pull different permits for each aspect of this and frankly put it together yourself. Very difficult challenge to do. Three ring binders on bookshelves, very difficult to integrate. in response, we now have Title V permits. I know, yawn. This is actually important. Title V permits integrate all of these into one master permit. And then to put some venom into the bite, it says that people who get Title V permits have to certify that they're complying with their Title V permits twice a year, essentially submitting to the agency a report saying, I've looked as best I can, and I can tell you, Scout's Honor, I'm complying with all my other permits. Here's the catch. If you falsely certify, it's criminal. But I will tell you, CEOs, refinery managers, environmental managers take Title V real seriously because it's their name that goes in the line. When you hear jokes about designated inmates at companies, Title V is usually the one that's driving that concern. And the last one is kind of fun, and I will be honest with you, we probably won't spend much time on it today, but I just will mention it to you, which is stratospheric ozone. Not the ozone that we all happily and cheerfully breathe in Houston every day. This is ozone that is at the upper layers of the stratosphere that shield us from ultraviolet radiation. This is in response to the ozone hole, which I'm sure all of you have also heard about, since you know about acid rain. This is, yes? Good. No? Yes? It's hard to read your head nods sometimes. All right. Who knows what the ozone hole is? Okay. Very briefly. And very briefly, because like I said, we're not going to talk about this title, but I'd like for you to just know where it is. It turns out that there was a certain chemical, class of chemicals that were manufactured because they were frankly viewed as wonder chemicals, CFCs, chlorinated fluorocarbons. Turns out CFCs were perfect for being a fire-resistant dielectric chemical. Essentially, you would find CFCs in all sorts of electrical equipment and being used in manufacturing processes to blow foam, ubiquitous chemical, used in bulk. Turns out that DuPont and Dow had big stakes in it. Well, what we didn't realize is that it's also a perfect scavenger of ozone. So little small amounts of it would be released at the ground level, work their way up over a period of months to the upper stratosphere, and then one molecule of CFCs would wipe out hundreds, if not thousands, of molecules of ozone. And you'd end up with a slowly growing hole every winter over Antarctica, to the point where it's actually getting to the bottom portions of Australia and South America. All right. Abstract, interesting, it has a real-world consequence. Without ultraviolet radiation screening from ozone, you have increases in incidences of skin cancer, cataracts, other types of health impacts. So how do you fix a problem like ozone? It's a thousands, if not millions of sources, and it's not just one source of one country, they're all over the world. Everybody's using it. What we ended up with was essentially a treaty, a framework treaty, promulgated under the auspices of the UN, that said everyone will agree in the future on limits on these chemicals. And then we ended up with a protocol under that treaty called the Vienna, it's the Vienna Convention, but then there's the Montreal Protocol, which essentially began the process of phasing out CFCs, little by little. This is viewed as one of the biggest success stories in environmental law. The ozone, the amount of CFCs and HCFCs in the atmosphere is drastically reduced. The ozone hole is no longer growing, it's actually actively shrinking. And the way that it was regulated was actually viewed as very effective, in part because it relied in part on market mechanisms. So why am I going into this besides the fact it's kind of appeals to perhaps some of the techno-nerd aspects of environmental law? Because it's a template for greenhouse gases. Think about it. Sources all over the world, everybody emits greenhouse gases, CO2 in particular. It mixes into the atmosphere and causes a global undifferentiated harm. How do you regulate it? Well, a lot of people think that Title VI is not only a good model, but actually may be a toehold of jurisdiction because a lot of these CFCs are also greenhouse gases. And not just that, they're super potent greenhouse gases. So I'll pause. Is this all mosaic starting to hang together for you? Okay. Now, I will freely admit it's kind of a mess. There's no integrated rationale here. This is not a statute that was written with a grand sense of a cathedral logic. It's an accumulation of experience and responses to problems and court decisions parts of it written in 1972, parts written in 1977, the most recent, most active portions written in 1990. So you have to read it with that eye that if you have an air quality problem, you've got to figure out where your entry point is, what kind of air quality problem it is, and then figure out if multiple titles might apply to it. And then figure out how you're going to integrate those sometimes conflicting legal requirements into a coherent strategy or permit level. This story I've told you, you may sound vaguely familiar. It's part of like the Clean Water Act. It'll certainly be like what we talk about with hazardous waste statutes. Okay, so all hanging together, feeling the vibe. I almost made a Bernie Sanders joke there. Okay, what we're going to talk about today is mainly mobile sources and ambient air quality. I'm going to cheat. Normally, I would have given you about a 60-page reading assignment today and asked you to do Title I and Title II because there's just that much air stuff to cover. Instead, if you will let me tax your patience, I'd like to just talk you through Title II and then provide some materials and PowerPoints, and then we can spend the rest of the class talking about Title I, which is really, frankly, the real workhorse of the Clean Air Act. So with that in mind, let me sort of begin with Title II. And bottom line on Title II is that it is, first of all, important because air pollution is a multivariable problem. Translating that into English, and I think I put this in the wrong day, this is actually for today's reading, it's not tomorrow's. Sources of air pollution. This is actually a list of composition of where your air pollution comes from, broken down by major cities in Texas. And what you'll notice is that based on pollutant and based on source, it changes dramatically where it's coming from. The blue bars are from what was called stationary fuel combustion, big giant boilers, you know, power plants. The yellow are industrial and other processes. And then the red and light blue are the mobile sources. Notice that for PM, particulate matter, the vast majority is from stationary sources. If you're looking at sulfur dioxide, mobile sources virtually don't matter. But if you're talking about carbon monoxide, if you're talking about lead, you're talking about mobile source problem. So essentially, Title II tackles pollutants that are largely attributable to sources of combustion engines that are used to transport or haul stuff. As a result, it actually is one of the earliest parts of the Clean Air Act, one of the first parts that were implemented. And it's one of the ones that really tackles the root of one of the toughest problems, because if you look at most air problems in most municipalities, most big cities, it's usually a transportation problem. Houston included. As we're getting more effective at controlling major stationary sources, most of our problem is increasingly becoming cars. Yeah?
Which of the stationary sources, which title do they fall under?
Well, that's an interesting question. They fall under 1, 3, 4, and 6. Okay. They're just basically, if you're a stationary source, you know, buckle in your seatbelt, multiple provisions may apply to you. It depends what you're emitting and how you're emitting it. But if you're doing Title II, mobile source, it's only Title II. So what are the hallmarks of Title II? Why is it different? Well, let me sort of tell you its DNA, and then we can figure out how, when we get to Title I, we go in a different pathway. The thing about Title II is that it is heavily technology-driven. If you look at the original congressional directive, effectively, they just simply said, we are hereby passing a law saying that you will reduce air pollution from cars and mobile sources by 90% in 5 years. And at this point, the industry and EPA, EPA wasn't quite in existence, but agencies at that point sputtered and said, what? How? And Congress's response was, that's your problem. Figure it out. This is one of the most quintessential and early examples of a technology-forcing statute. The only demonstration at that point of the technology that ultimately helped achieve that goal, the catalytic converter, was essentially on a bench scale in a laboratory. But because of this technology-driving statute, enormous resources are devoted to developing that technology, making it commercializable, and then implementing it. It also fueled an enormous boom in litigation, because, of course, the first thing that the big three did out of Detroit was file lawsuits and request extensions and claim it was unconstitutional, and that how could they comply with a law that was manifestly impossible. In a way, they lost. All of those claims are ultimately rejected by the courts. In a way, they won. It took 10 years before the standards were actually implemented because in part of the litigation challenges. But the bottom line is that Title II ultimately was effective in reducing dramatically emissions from cars, but not only cars, but also trucks, less so with major sources, major heavy construction equipment, non-spark engines, ships, planes. We're still working our way through those sources, but for cars, it's been enormously effective. So as a result, we are now on a point where EPA is ratcheting it down and ratcheting it down as it's directed to by the statute. We are now at Tier 2 and Tier 3 ultra-clean fuels. And the process is essentially still driven by technology. The agency determines what is the achievable level that can be attained, driven by potential technology. They assess the cost, they're allowed to under the statute, of whether or not they can acquire that use of that technology, but then it slowly gets pulled down further and further. The big issues right now for fuel, they've reduced sulfur dramatically because sulfur is one of the big health problems of burning fuel. And I should be respectful of the fact that many of you are either working at energy companies, will work at energy companies, or have parents who work at energy companies. So everything I say here I think is value neutral. So, but call me if you find any perspectives creeping into my comments. Sulfur, ultra low sulfur is one of the big issues that we're now finally beginning to circle around to achieving. The big issue now is whether or not it's possible to create low carbon fuels, which are now being mandated increasingly at state levels. But that's a tricky tale, as I'll explain in a minute. But the key number one thing about Title II is that it's technology driven. And if you think about that, that makes sense. As opposed to all the stationary sources scattered around the United States that vary in different places, locations, what they make and how they make it, cars are still largely made in one location in the United States by a large small collection of large companies or by importers. So as a result, it's possible to use that as the fulcrum point to introduce technology to a small universe that then spreads out and covers the entire United States. If you think about it, though, that also automatically leads to the other things about Title II I want to share with you. It's different in other ways in the sense of that this is the most federal of all the programs in the Clean Air Act. As we'll talk about in a minute, and also especially on Wednesday, Title I is very much state-driven. EPA sets the standards, the state has to figure out how to implement it. Title III, same thing, delegation to state authority. Title IV, very much. You have EPA allocating the credits, but there's still a role for the states. Title II is all about the federal program. And if you think about it, that's because if you're an auto manufacturer, the last thing you want is having to hit 50 different standards for your engines based on where your cars are being driven to. The last thing you want is 50 different fuel standards. Your gasoline has to change what level of purity it has based on where it's being sold. Now, that's still largely the case. As a result, if a state tries to regulate the way an engine burns, the odds are very high it is preempted by Title II. If a state tries to set a boutique fuel standard, I guarantee you there will be a fight on whether or not that fuel is going to be preempted and requires EPA approval, not state approval. So, one, technology-driven. Two, it is a standard that is driven very much by federal standards. Now, of course, I'm going to complicate it for you because it's, you need to have something to add to your outlines. The thing here is that, yes, it's very much federally driven, but there is the dreaded California exception. And all I can do is point you to history. I wish I could tell you there's something rational about why California gets separate treatment. The honest truth is that California had their own clean air program. How many of you have been to Los Angeles by any chance recently? What was the air like when you were there?
I don't know if you could call that air.
It's not quite Beijing or New Delhi.
True.
But you can see it.
Very true. Yeah. It's pretty dense.
Yeah. You think Houston's got ozone problems, but Los Angeles is essentially the perfect ozone-making machine.
Yeah.
And you have a huge amount of cars driven with mountains surrounding it, essentially corralling that with all those precursors for ozone that bake in that South California sun. And they have air quality that is, certainly in the late 60s was unbelievably bad. So California wasn't waiting for the Clean Air Act. they had their own program that was actually pretty aggressive and better in the sense of being more stringent than the federal standards. Well, when they passed the statute, there was a huge concern in California that Title II was going to preempt their gold level standard program. So as a result, the statute does provide for the ability to use California standards instead of federal. It requires, first of all, a petition by California to EPA for approval that their standards are just as good as or better than EPA standards. And until recently, pro forma, easy, brain dead. This is zombie law. Never denied. But here's where the catch comes in. Once that petition's approved for California, any other state can adopt the standard instead of the federal standard. So California became a one-way ratchet under Title II. It was able to drive tougher standards by itself by setting a high level of control, and then other states who chose to could adopt them. And ultimately what happened is it just took California, New York, Florida, Texas, Illinois, a handful of states, and then just drove, sometimes independent of EPA, the discussion about regulation for cars. So, I will now ask your indulgence. Having gotten this tale, I hope some of you are going, wait a minute, that'll make sense maybe for car pollutants like ozone or nitrous oxides or lead. What about greenhouse gases? What would happen if California passed its own greenhouse gas standard for cars? And the short answer is they did. And the short answer is once they did, EPA, this was during the George W. Bush administration, I'll here pause for a moment and let you exercise your brain cells. What do you predict the reaction was when that California petition landed on EPA's desk? Pretend you're Roman emperors. Thumbs up or thumbs down?
Thumbs down.
There we go. Thank you. You were the fastest, so you could have the toga for today.
Okay.
Yes. Remember, easy, automatic grantle, zombie law, no more. So I'm going to ask your indulgence to let me tell you the rest of the story, because ultimately it came to Texas. And I was in the debates at the Greatest of Partnership over whether or not the industry was going to advocate the adoption of California standards for greenhouse gas emissions in cars. And think about, when we get, you know, in advance, give you a chance to marinate it, why would industry be pushing for tougher standards on cars in Houston?
Well, I was just going to ask and clarify, if so the states get to choose if they want the EPA federal standards or a tougher, stricter standard, California ones, but then they get to control it, they get to regulate those?
Essentially, now what happens is that by adopting California standards, they become in lieu of the federal law. So it's still essentially EPA oversight, but they don't, it does become a state program at that point. Essentially, it means though that instead of being the EPA standards, you have to meet the tougher California standards, but it's still an EPA administered program, which sounds weird, but. But I'm sorry, now you've got to be thinking about, that's an interesting question. Because you would think that if you're doing this California standards, you would also get control of the program too. Let me find out more about that and see what the story is. It's a great question. Okay, any other questions? Are you sure? Because I'm seeing furrowed brows out in the audience. Okay. Help me remember the factors so far for Title II are number one, you are listening. This is so fabulous. Either that or you're reading your notes, which is, but still just as good. Number two?
Federal.
All right. So now we get to, if it's all federal and it's preemptive and it's technology driven, what's left in the pantry for the states? What can they do if they're preempted from regulating engines? If you're Houston and it turns out that if you look at the bars, that our problem is increasingly the mobile sources, we can't regulate them. What can we do? Well, it turns out you can get at cars through surrogates. And this is another important part of the Title II program. You may not be able to tell someone how their engine must emit, but you can tell the person who owns that engine when they can drive it. Transportation control measures, TCMs. Make sure you get your daily allotment of acronyms for today. Local governments can tell when you can drive, how you can drive. They can put HOV lanes in. They can say that you get special perks and prerogatives if you drive an electric car. Transportation control measures are a very important and effective tool. They also can backfire. If you have a real severe ozone problem, like Boston did or Southern California, and you say, my transportation control measure is you can't drive except every other day, or you can't drive unless your license plate ends in an even number, how do you think the voting populace reacted to that?
Not well.
There you go. Pitchforks and flaming brands is the sort of image I want you to have in mind. In addition to transportation control measures, you can also make sure that that car is actually working the way it should.
Smog check.
That's right, smog check. Go wait in line, run the dynamometer to make sure your engine's working the way it should. They measure what comes out. And if you flunk, you go buy whatever you need to fix your car. Otherwise, you can't drive it. Alex?
Sorry, just a funny thing about these transportation control measures. I mean, they have these in a lot of developing countries. So like whenever I went to Ecuador or in Manila in the Philippines, they have what was called ticket tack, which was like if you had a certain license plate or a certain permit, you can only drive 1 or 2 days a week. But the wealthy people that could afford cars anyway, they just bought enough cars to be able to drive every day of the week.
No,
so
absolutely.
It's like you can circumvent it anyway.
You know the examples I just gave? There was a lot of discussion about that. People would just get two cars.
Yep.
And instead of one new, nice, clean, efficient, emitting car, you get two junkers,
yep,
which are emitting much worse. So there was a lot of reasons why it was a bad policy. But you're right. In the developing countries, TCMs are actually, they're really all you got. You can't do some of these technology-driven standards we're talking about. Any other comments or questions? Okay. So why does inspection matter? Why does putting your car into the dynamometer and seeing what comes out matter? It turns out that there's a huge tail for old cars. If you look at, let's just say, the age of the car and the amount that it emits, the new cars are amazingly efficient. And they do a fabulous job. And the further back you get, you might get a little bit more. But when you get to the junkers, the cars you buy for your teenagers, the rent-a-wrecks, emissions go up dramatically. Like, we're talking one old junker car can offset the emissions for 50 to 100 newer cars. So getting those cars off the road makes a huge impact. Here's the next question. I talked about flaming pitchforks and flaming brands. Who do you think owns the junkers, rent-a-wrecks, and older emitting, high-emitting cars? Who's more likely to, folks in this room or folks in the Fifth Ward? It's not a trick question, guys, really. Both? Well, I guess it's true. Students is a bad population.
Talk about a poor population.
All right. How many rent-a-wrecks and junkers do you think are driving around Westview and River Oaks right now?
Not too many.
Yeah. It has a huge disparate impact on poor, environmentally justice disadvantaged populations. So we actually have programs where you actually can get a subsidy to get your car fixed, and there are programs that actually buy the junkers and trash them. Cash for clunkers. And that's all it is. It's an air quality control measure. Rather than putting out a new tailpipe control, it's a lot easier just to buy that old truck and compact it to a little metal cube.
Luckily, they also built in grandfathering clauses for old collectible vehicles.
Yes, very much so.
Thankfully.
You sound like someone who appreciates a fine Aston Martin.
I have collected and driven and owned classic vehicles for a while now.
Well,
it's a pain to have to get like a 68 Corvette equipped with a catalytic converter when it wasn't manufactured at that time.
Absolutely. If you have a chance that they actually get the John O'Quinn Vintage Automobile Museum up, but he was also a big fan of that.
Nice.
He had
1,200
cars.
That's a lot.
Did you ever a chance to see him speak though?
No.
I know for all of you guys, he's just that kind of disquieting portrait down the library. Is it still down there where he's watching you as you study? He may have had his quirks and he may have had some of his ethical challenges. Like I say, I watched him speak. The man truly cast a spell. That's the best metaphor I can think to describe it. The room would go dead silent and almost people would stop breathing. And he would be talking about incredibly dull stuff like expert testimony at emission standards. And everyone was enchanted. It's just, he had some sort of charismatic gift that if he had been a politician, it would have been scary to think what he could have done. I'm sorry, Ali, did I make you sneeze? All right, so
Before we leave Title II behind, I want to make sure we have time to talk about Title I in our two cases for today. There has been one particular car company that has been in the news lately. It makes Title II hopefully come home for you in a vivid way. So let me ask, and feel free to not answer if you don't want to, but how many of you own Jettas? What do you own?
I own an Eos, but I thought you were just going to say Volkswagen, because I knew what we were talking.
Yeah, exactly. So is Eos a Volkswagen? Mm-hmm. Okay, so is it covered by the same emissions control scheme?
No.
Okay. Are you sure?
I remember I checked when we talked about it last semester.
Okay.
I think it was clear there aren't very many of them.
Okay. Does anyone else own VW/Jettas? All right. I just couldn't resist, but as we all know, Volkswagen has been in the news because it has engaged in something quite rare in environmental law, a massive corporate conspiracy. And there's no other way to describe it. The company at the highest levels made a decision that the silly Title II stuff wasn't going to affect their model. They were actually going to sell their cars and comply with Title II by cheating. So they installed what's called a defeat device, a mechanism that only turns on when the car is actually being tested and the car can detect when it's being tested. You put on that dynamometer and you're checking the emissions. This little tiny chip inside the car turns on, and at that point, wow, the emissions look great. The mileage sucks, but the emissions look fabulous. As soon as you're off the dynamometer, the machine turns off, your emissions go through the roof, but you've got great gas mileage. That type of corporate fraud, you just don't see very often, and it tends to get attention when it does happen. I just handed Art, and hopefully around the class, a very large civil lawsuit that the United States has filed against VW. VW is in the process now of negotiating resolution of civil and criminal penalties under Title II. The penalties right now are ranging into the billions of dollars. They're actually, and this is pretty amazing, they're actually doing calculations of the Department of Justice on how much they can penalize VW without bankrupting the company. Not because they necessarily feel fondness for beetles and bugs, but because it actually has foreign affairs implications if you bankrupt one of the major employers of one of your allies. So, it's Title II has some teeth to it. I couldn't resist, for those of you who are interested, I put on the website. Here is this is the actual schematic they've been using to illustrate the device. But essentially, these had to be actually installed into the cars. This is not a dual-use device that had some other purpose. They were installed specifically to be defeat devices. So I did make a rash prediction that if VW did this, other companies probably did too, just to be able to be competitive. But I have to confess, other than Audi kind of having some short circling around it, I haven't heard any cases so far. So I saw a couple of hands go up. Hart first?
I just wondered, how long did they do this?
Good question. I know it's at least over a decade.
Really?
Yeah.
That's crazy.
Yeah, think about all the greenhouse and pollutants that went up in the air during that time. Did you have anything though?
I worked on this case a little bit, the Texas
Oh, that's right, because the county attorney's office.
The AG's yeah. office.
The AG's
Austin.
Office.
Yeah.
Okay.
And I just thought it was interesting that the way that they really caught him was a bunch of students from West Virginia who had like a science lab experiment. They were testing different cars, and their data was not matching up from their in-laboratory up on the wheels tests and then in their road tests, and they couldn't figure it out. And so they went to the company and were like, hey, what's up, guys? You know, and they sent their data to a lab in California, and they checked it too and did road tests versus the lab test. And so your science projects can have major implications.
Yeah, but I can't resist sort of the senior side of that. What did the company say when they got this letter from some bright-eyed students who are saying, geez, sir, what's going on?
Well, that's what kind of makes it egregious, is that was years before, the scandal broke, so that's like evidence of,
Okay, I was hoping that they said something like, go away, kid, you bother me.
No.
Okay. So I know the Harris County Attorney's Office filed one of the very first lawsuits to collect civil penalties from VW because of the damage it did to our air quality attainment efforts. But I didn't realize the state AG was also part of that, too. Mm-hmm. So have they filed an action, too?
Yeah, they did. And it was... confusing because they have that, the Texas has this necessary and indispensable party statute, which is kind of like a bounty statute for all the municipalities and city attorneys. They can file environmental lawsuits, name the state as a necessary and indispensable party, and then they have to work with them to resolve it. So it's kind of, it's good and bad. It's interesting. We have a bunch of attack dog lawyers out there looking for environmental crimes that they can file suit about, but it's weird from a state agency perspective.
At the risk of going on a tangent, I have to say, it's interesting how your perspective colors the way you look at the world. Because the necessary indispensable parties provision has been viewed not as a net to haul in the state against its will in the lawsuits. When dealing with industry down here, our response is typically, wow, that's overreaching by Austin to insert themselves into our lawsuits. What a pain in the rear. So I hadn't really thought about it from that perspective. It's interesting, because essentially you can force the state to participate even if they don't want to.
I just had a question about kind of the development of more like electric cars.
Mm-hmm.
Since they don't have any emissions, is that kind of changed it to where it, now it's only under Title I, or do they do it kind of by proxy since like it kind of inadvertently it's kind of creating more emissions, but just through, I guess, now a stationary source instead? Or
indirectly. EPA, there's no fuel requirement for most electric cars. EPA still regulates hybrid cars, and they'll regulate fuel cell cars that have hydrogen that is used as a fuel. Electric cars, you just charge them up.
Right.
So what they've done instead is they actually are encouraging the development of electric cars by letting states use electric cars to meet their air budgets. So essentially, if you have a law like in California which mandates that a certain percentage of the auto fleet must be zero emissions vehicles, essentially, EPA is promoting the sales and introduction of electric cars, even though they can't actually regulate them because they don't have emissions themselves. So you have to give them credit for some cleverness there.
Yeah.
Okay, any other thoughts, questions, ideas, suggestions, brilliant ideas for research papers, projects we can do to get criminal corporations in trouble? Okay. Let me give one last thought, which is, I've talked about cars, a little bit about trucks and other mobile sources. The other big part of Title II, which is also heavily federally driven, also preemptive, also technology available, is fuel. EPA regulates what goes in your gas tank. And that regulation is very extensive. It's relatively prescriptive. And you would be quite as impressed by the degree of technical specificity EPA insists on. The flash point of your gasoline, the read vapor pressure of your gasoline, to what extent it contains olefins or other types of materials. And as a result, EPA is very powerful in determining what fuels get on the market and how. So number one, if you want to sell gasoline, be prepared to spend a lot of time in the Office of Mobile Sources of the EPA in DC. Number two, if you want to sell something that's not gasoline, but that's a fuel, be prepared to navigate some obstacles. That's one of the reasons I was in Arizona last week. We were working on technologies and talking about the legal implications of what happens when you capture CO2 out of the air and convert it into fuel. And they're actually pretty close to that technology right now, using renewable energy to do it. Then everyone was very excited. The scientists were saying, we can do this. It's not cost competitive yet, but we can get it down. And then no one had thought at all about the fact that if you're blending it with gasoline or selling it as a fuel, you're going to have to get EPA's approval. And no one had a clue on what that might mean. And it's a whole brand new territory. I'll stop there. I mean, we could have a whole semester on Title II and fuels and cars. It's a really cool area. Any questions or thoughts? Last chance. If you are interested, there is one thing I will pass on before we move to Title I, which is if you really like this stuff and you're interested in ways to control mobile source emissions, even though states lack the tools to do it, there is a group called the Texas Clean Air Working Group, which is essentially every county government in the state that has air quality problems. And they are meeting in Austin next week, and they are going to be essentially figuring out how to respond to the new ozone standards. One of the key things that they want to do is essentially a buyout program.
We have a program that essentially is called TERP, the Texas Emissions Reduction Program. Why am I writing this? Because in about 3 weeks, we'll also be talking about TERP, which is the Texas Risk Reduction Program, which is for hazardous waste. Don't, different program. TERP is a beautiful thing. Essentially, if you buy sports equipment, you're contributing to it. It's a special state fund that is now over $1 billion. Essentially a war chest that lets the state go out and buy emission reductions. Get those clunkers off the road. Install new types of emissions controls on locomotives. Have different types of new technology designed out there to deal with particular kinds of bubble sources from dispersed areas. So TERP is sort of, right now, the big area where we're trying to figure out Title II compliance issues and Title I ozone, which we'll get to in a minute. And for those who are interested, it's a semi-open group. I'm going to try and get to that meeting and would be glad to have one of you join me if you'd like to. All right, so deep breath. That's the first half of class today. Anything else you want to talk about before we go to Title I, which is the big enchilada? Okay, and I'm going to erase this part over here. We are about to change the polarity of our regulatory discussion by 180 degrees, which is, namely, what do you do when you don't look at the source of emissions, what's coming out of the tailpipe? Instead, you just look at the soup that you breathe every day. It's called ambient air standards. In particular, we're going to be talking about national ambient air quality standards, NAAQS. The idea behind NAAQS is that there's a certain small number of pollutants that are ubiquitous if you go to most urban areas. And as a result, instead of trying to set a technology standard that applies to the vast array of sources that contribute to it, you start at the other end and say, what do we need to do to get this particular pollutant down to a safe level? So now, I'm going to pause for a second, because one of the things that happens in this class is we're 40 years late to the game. The statutes have been written, until this year, they've been sitting for 20 years at least untouched. A lot of these decisions have gotten made, and after a while, you'll discover they feel inevitable. They feel like, well, that's the obvious answer. But pause for a minute. Put yourself in the shoes of the legislators and regulators in 1970 and 1977, and you've been told, we have to get smog under control. All right? And then they close the door, and they say, you figure it out. What are the questions you ask to regulate smog, which is another way of calling ozone? Before you answer, let me give you a couple of quick data points. None of you and none of our industrial facilities emit smog. No one emits smog. Smog is actually created, ozone's created, when you emit two precursors, nitrous oxides plus volatile organic compounds, into the air, and then you bake them in sunlight. So if you take a look at most pictures, most maps of cities, what you'll see is that ozone kind of bubbles up as the day comes along. Levels rise as the heat causes the VOC NOx reactions. Of course, that's not the whole story. Ozone also persists, so you'll actually see it kind of stay in the air and it becomes a baseline for the next day. But the bottom line is that you're having to deal with classes of chemicals that come together, and that you literally have hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of sources of them. So, if that's our challenge, what's the first question you're going to ask yourself about controlling ozone? And there's no right answer here. I'm just curious, if you're faced with this with a blank slate piece of paper, what would you want to know first?
What's the NOx? What is it?
Nitrous oxide.
I guess try to figure out where's that nitrous oxide. If you just take away one of those elements, obviously you can't take the sun away, but take away just one of those, find out where the biggest polluters are, you can try to reduce.
Okay, that's a great starting question. So what are the sources of NOx? And frankly, why not do it for both?
know, there may be different groups, but they're still both sources.
What is the other one? BOC?
Volatile organic compounds. Ethylene, propylene, it can be benzene. It's essentially, how many of you have had organic chemistry in here? There, you know what I'm talking about then.
Yeah.
Okay. If you have a precise definition, please offer it up at any point.
That's fine.
Okay, thank you. My promise, I will not pick on you for the rest of the semester because you divulged that you have knowledge. It's a terrible temptation. Okay, sources. All right, but once we identify our sources, how do we know what to tell them?
I guess we would have to figure out what is acceptable levels.
Okay.
And what measures
so why not?
We need to take to get there. Because we got to figure out where the ground is.
Oh, so like natural emissions of ozone.
Yeah, so you got to figure out what's your baseline.
And okay.
Figure out how far are we over that, and how do we get closer back to that baseline.
So what is baseline? Because that could be different approaches to that.
I'm thinking like parts per million. Like, you know, is there a way to figure out what's naturally occurring parts per million? And then what we're doing as humans.
Okay, so like if we were to see that there was like 100 parts per billion of ozone in the air, and we broke it down, we might find 50 parts per billion come from natural sources.
Trees.
So that's what you mean by baseline, is that sort of, the stuff we really, unless we're gonna start cutting down trees, there's not a whole lot we can do about. And by the way, this is actually true. I know Ronald Reagan took a lot of heat for saying forests cause ozone, and he deservedly did, because he kind of made it in a broad way. But I was actually at a presentation of a paper 2 weeks ago where they're breaking down which trees cause the most volatile organic compounds that cause the most ozone. And you can actually choose which trees will have the least ozone impact in cities to plant. The big issue, of course, is no one who's planting trees in cities knows that. So we're having to figure that out. All right, so 50 parts per billion natural, 50 parts per billion industrial. So are you saying get rid of that, and then we'll just sort of have to lump it with the other?
I don't think you're going to ever be able to get rid of that.
Why not?
You're talking about crushing industry. Like, that's not going to happen.
Why not?
Because we live in a capitalist society, and industry drives that.
Okay. And that is a valid answer. If I can torture you just gently, just slightly.
Always.
Okay. Let's draw a really bad image of the state of Texas.
Okay. That's good. Honestly, that's pretty good.
Thank you. You're quite right. There's a lot of industry right here. If we said, go away, pollute no more, bless you. It turns out there's lots of other parts of the state where you actually don't have 50 parts per billion background of ozone. I mean.
But they thrive off of everything that's brought into this city.
So because we're near the water?
Well, it's the largest ship channel in the United States. I mean, mm-hmm. That's one piece of it. But, I mean, and the money that Houston and Dallas generate.
But the point is, that's a choice.
Oh, I agree, completely agree.
It is also possible to choose that you're going to disperse your industry and lose the advantages of consolidation of transportation, but at the same time, disperse the pollution footprint among a broader area. The other possibility is we could simply say, you know what, Houston, we're condemning your air. Why does everyone have to have the same amount of air that's exactly the same quality or purity? We'll just say, just like we do with water, some water is swimmable, some water is fishable, some water is industrial, and you better not be diving into it. Why don't we do the same with air? That's a rhetorical question. I don't know the answer to it. I could offer some, but I will say I tend to have this argument with economists for some reason. Okay, but I think we're circling around perhaps the real heart of the issue, which is, assume we can drive this down, how far down do we go?
Yeah.
I mean, is there a safe level of ozone?
I guess that's what I was getting at, is what is acceptable.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So say the rats don't roll on their backs, put their feet in the air, we expose them to 70 parts per billion of ozone. Would it make sense to require a reduction down to 60 parts per billion?
Well, I mean, you got to look at not only short term, like if you breathe it, will your lungs like disintegrate? But mm-hmm. long term, like what's it going to do?
So it's not just, bless you.
Thank you.
You are like my living example of air quality problems today.
I'm allergic to a lot of stuff.
Yeah, I had a terrible time when I got off the plane here from Arizona. I was like sneezing. Something's blooming right now. Point being, and I've totally lost the point. Priya, this is your fault.
Ozone.
Ozone, thank you. all right, we were talking about levels and what might be considered to be acceptable, and you were saying, Art, let's not just acute exposed walking your way to the parking lot till you can get your windows rolled up. It's what you breathe every day.
Yeah, it's not like wearing a mask when you walk in Hong Kong. Yeah,
which is a great example.
It's long term.
Okay, so I'll give you that. It turns out we can let rats run on the treadmill for all their healthy long lifespan at 70 parts per billion, and they're fine. I mean, arguably can extrapolate that data to humans. Is that good enough? And by the way, I'm not just picking on Art. Anyone can jump in on this, too. Because this, I'll tell you, giving away the punchline, is the driving question on air quality in Title I. At least these days. What is a safe level? How do you choose it? How do you make sure it stays current as you learn more? If I could give one suggestion, suppose we have, someone who is an athlete strapping, running around, great shape, and they are just fine with 90 parts per million. But then we have someone who has severe allergies, and Priya can only handle 40 parts per billion. Where do you set the standard? Do you protect everybody? Do you protect the most sensitive subpopulation? And if so, where do you draw that line? I'm sure that you saw in our readings for today that right now a lot of that line's not being driven by people in this classroom. It's not being driven by people in the street. It's being driven by children. And if you think about it, that makes a lot of sense. Children effectively have less body weight, more lung space exposure compared to adults. So, and they're also more vulnerable. They're still growing. So as a result, they tend to have the most air quality exposure difficulties first. Now I'll pause here. Does that make sense for everybody? So to a certain extent, the sensitive subpopulations in children tend to drive things like our air quality standard NAAQS for things like ozone. And by the way, we're going to expand this to cover all the other NAAQS for other pollutants as well. But here's my question for you to think about. Where do you stop? There was a lawsuit filed, for example, at the Americans with Disabilities Act for people who had impaired immune systems because they'd either been through chemotherapy or had a natural condition from a result of illness, claiming that the air quality standards effectively were way too high for them. And that if you're going to choose a sensitive subpopulation, why are you choosing kids? Choose the people who are really in danger. Does that make sense for folks? All right, going with our Roman gladiator model right now, how many of you would actually find that if you were a judge, you would entertain that lawsuit even? No, Art kills the plaintiffs.
I'd make a move.
You'd make a move, okay. Backwoods of Alaska, maybe?
Somewhere with better air.
Okay.
You're an exception to the rule.
How many of you would not make the move? Okay. So kind of a mix here. Some of you would make them live in the bubble.
Well, it depends on the classroom. Like there's just too much diversity in that to certify as a class action suit. That's what it was, right?
Mm-hmm. Actually, no. It was a small group. They were actually really focused on particulate matter from burning from controlled forest fires.
Okay.
So it was a small group in a geographic area, and they were exposed, and so they were it's a mass collective plaintiffs group, but it wasn't a class. But you're right, it could be a class. But let's assume that the question of the individuality of different harms they suffer makes a problem. Let's just say 20 plaintiffs. Yes, once again, I'm asking you questions that the judge in that case was Art. He threw him out. Actually, I think she threw him out. But the question's been engaged. I've heard people discuss whether or not individuals with multiple chemical sensitivity syndrome might be the ultimate sensitive population. Should we account for them in setting national ambient air quality standards? For now, here is, I just wanted to let you think about that. It's not only who's getting exposed. Notice I have sneakily skipped past another important question, which is, what are they being exposed to? Because I started with ozone. That's sort of our old familiar friend here in Houston. But if you were to go and take a look at this air quality, let's see if I can get that a little bigger. Okay. If we were to walk out with an air bottle, take a sample and analyze it, we wouldn't just find ozone. We would just find particulate matter. We wouldn't just find sulfur. We'd find an enormous array of interesting, unusual substances you never dreamed you were breathing every day. One of the most persistent pollutants right now is formaldehyde. It's off-gas from different types of installations and coatings and buildings. This is a map that shows essentially grab samples taken in a neighborhood near the refinery. I'm hoping we're going to go visit the end of the semester. Essentially, they had a mobile van with lab equipment drive around and just sample and see what was coming out. And lo and behold, lots of benzene. How do we choose from the soup we're exposed to every day? And I use that term value neutrally, just the mix of different substances, and decide which ones need to have a national ambient air quality standard. Do we do it for all? Which ones are the really bad actors we have to care about? Before you answer, let me tell you that developing a NAAQS is one of the most difficult and expensive propositions that EPA ever tries to undertake. For now, the short answer, as you know from your reading, is that a certain element of prudent cowardice has settled in. The agency has only chosen a very short list of NAAQS that they keep developing standards for and updating. The ones that tend to be the most important for our purposes are sulfur dioxide, particulate matter, ozone, lead, and carbon monoxide. One quick note. When you talk about ozone, the standard now is ozone and particulate matter, 2.5. What does that mean? And the reason I know I'm not throwing irrelevant but cool detail at you, it actually makes a huge difference in what we're going to talk about. This is the size of the particulate matter. It used to be PM10, 10 microns in diameter. By going from PM10 to PM2.5, we're talking about extremely fine particles that you cannot see. This is not smoke. The thing about PM2.5 is that it's so small, it goes right to the deepest part of your lungs. It also turns out that PM2.5, since it's so small, it has more surface area per mass, which means it has a bigger punch in terms of toxicity for the amount that you breathe in. And it turns out that if you look at epidemiological data, that ozone is a problem in terms of reduced lung capacity, but the PM2.5 that's also generated at the same time has a huge impact on blood pressure, heart attacks, cardiovascular incidents, and it's a serious health driver in bad air days. So, circling back, short answer is we do look to sensitive individuals to set our national ambient air quality standards. They tend to be children. They tend to be people who are asthmatic. We haven't gone as far as to include people who have particular medical conditions that make them uniquely vulnerable. But nonetheless, it's not the average individual who's being exposed. The National Ambient Air Quality Standards have not covered everything we breathe, but basically are focused on key criteria pollutants. They're called national criteria pollutants by the statute. Ozone, particulate matter, carbon monoxide, lead. Sorry. I'm having a terrible time writing today. Different nitrous oxides and sulfur dioxide. I think I'm missing one there as well. But the bottom line is that it's a fairly small universe. So where do the magic numbers come from? How do we set a health-based level under the statute for each of these national ambient air quality standards for each of these criteria pollutants? And the short answer is that it's driven by the statute. If you take a look at section 108 of the statute, it specifies that EPA effectively has to set standards with an adequate margin of safety. And it's committed to the discretion of the administrator of EPA. That adequate margin of safety must be geared to protect public health. Now, I should have been making air quotes while I said that. Your readings give you the precise language of the section. Notice what word is prominently not in that section. Going to Art's point. Money. There is not a whisper of the word cost. Think about what that means. Essentially, the statute says that when we're trying to decide what is a safe level to breathe, we don't care if you have to use platinum filters. We don't care if it has a huge impact to bring it down to that level. All we care about is what the doctors say as to what is a safe level we can expose someone to. And if that level is zero, the level is zero. Now, I'll pause here. Any questions about that? Because this gets relitigated over and over and over and over and over again in the Clean Air Act program. There was a case just last year in the Supreme Court on whether or not the Clean Air Act could consider cost in setting safe levels. And the court has consistently said cost ain't in the statute. Now, before I overstate this, those of you taking notes, for Wednesday, cost does come in the next stage when you figure out what the heck you're going to do about the level. Your control strategies are deeply embedded in cost discussions. But for deciding what's the safe level, cost is off the table. Does that make sense? Which means now we're to our two cases for today. And let me just touch on one, mainly because it's an interesting discussion. And then we'll save the big case, which every environmental attorney you meet will know, and it will give you great bonus points in interviews if you can tell them the case. American Trucking Association is one of the gold big cases of the environmental law world. But for now, you know, talking about our other case, I'm trying to think of how we can cover this. All right, I'm going to do all of you an injustice. If I could tell you very briefly some of the key things that we could pick up the conversation and actually talk about it on Wednesday, I'd like to do that. But the case we're talking about is the Lead Industries Association case. When you look at it for our discussion on Wednesday, let me flag a few things for you. Look when it was decided. This is one of the earlier cases. So it was actually answering foundational questions about the Clean Air Act. Look who wrote the decision. J. Skelly Wright. Have y'all talked about him, the J. Skelly Wright, in your other classes so far? Has he popped up? J. Skelly Wright is famous for being one of the most activist and intelligent judges to ever sit in the D.C. Circuit. And he's written extremely sweeping opinions about the scope of regulatory power to intervene in environmental and consumer safety issues. I flag this for you because you guys are graduating most likely into a world where, for the first time, the Supreme Court and other bodies underneath it will likely be more liberal in its orientation. And some of the case law from J. Skelly Wright, I will predict to you, will be coming back into the line. Now, what's interesting about the Lead Industry Association is it goes to the question we've all skipped over. We've talked about sensitive populations and children. And we just sort of blithely said harm. What is harm? What does it take to count as harm under Title I of the Clean Air Act? And what the Lead Industries Association case says, and I'll just, this is our tee-off point for starting discussion on Wednesday, is that it doesn't have to be blood, it doesn't have to be physical deformity, it doesn't have to be impairment of body function or breathing. It can be subclinical. It can be the expression of a hormone that's not tied to any physical impact yet, but is a precursor. It can be tied to the impairment of the functioning of a protein, that conveys oxygen from your blood cells to the body's liquid cells. That is enough to count as, quote, harm, close quote, for Section 108 of the Clean Air Act. EPA has the discretion to cast a very broad net. Now notice, it's still physical. It's not an impairment of rights or dignity or justice. It has to be linked to some physical mechanism. But it doesn't have to be something like a tort lawsuit where you actually have to show a concrete, manifested physical injury. Now, remember what I said when we started talking briefly about lead industries? This case is old. This case is one of the earliest epidemiological evidence about the expression of markers of precursors of disease. Think about this, and this is what we'll start on Wednesday. The state of the science today. Right now, I can tell you because I've seen it, EPA is working on genetic expression markers, where effectively exposure to a particular toxin or pollutant results in a particular transcription response from DNA, which means that the DNA is functioning a different way, but there's no clear link as to a particular manifested condition at the end result. All we know is that it's throwing things out of kilter. For example, that map I just showed you, part of the exposure that they did, they actually took slides of human lung cells and then took DNA assays of them to see how their functioning changed when they're exposed to ozone. Bottom line is, what is harm in our genetic world today? If we can find very small transcription alterations, is that harm for purposes of setting an axe? What else could count? And as you can tell, this is an open-ended question because EPA is wrestling with it right now, industry is wrestling with it right now, and if we can figure out the legal answer to that, you guys would be very rich indeed. All right? So, thoughts, questions, ideas, suggestions? All right? Then we'll start with wrapping up lead industries, talk about American trucking, and then we're going to focus on the actual implementation of NAAQS in Title I on Wednesday, which essentially means we're going to talk about the new source review and prevention of significant deterioration programs and how to get permits under. Okay. All right. Have a great day. I'll see everyone on Wednesday.